for this today's session is Christopher Dulé from Australian National University.
Okay, hello, welcome everybody. Let's start. The question I'm addressing in this talk is how to approach multilingualism when you're carrying out a documentation project from more or less from scratch, from a previously undescribed language. So the title before might suggest that I'm portraying multilingualism as a problem, and I want to make clear that this is indeed what I'm saying. So the presence of a number of varieties in one place where you go to and are supposed to describe it poses, of course, a lot of different problems, especially when you're a PhD who is struggling with all sorts of other problems. And so you have to worry about things like, who are you going to work with, what are your informants, what varieties are actually there, how different are they, what's the attitude of people towards these. We just heard some about this in China. And of course, why are people talking different languages? So, but of course, other than the documenter, it's not a problem for anybody, of course, on the ground. As we all know, even for the documenter, once you get over this initial stage, it will open up a whole range of very interesting research questions. But the topic for this talk today will be this initial stage of dealing with the whole situation. Okay, so this is the area where I'm working. This is the underbelly of the Papuan bird, just across the Torres Strait from Australia. The languages here are the Mohed Maro languages, also called Yam family. And the language I'm working on is called Komzo, in the middle there. Okay, so in terms of structure, this talk is more or less structured. I'll go into a bit of cultural background, and we'll need this. And then it's more or less structured chronologically in terms of my field trips. And of course, this is idealizing. As everybody knows, in field work, you work on a lot of things at the same time. But I've sort of put it here into categories, okay? And then I'll conclude. And each stage has sort of different topics that are addressed. So this will be much more a practical talk than the one before. Okay, so in terms of cultural background, I have to rush a bit because of the time. So in terms of cultural background, there's two excellent ethnographies of the area. One is written by the great F.E. Williams, and it covers the western part of the area and the eastern part of the area. And the other one is written by Mary Ayres, who I was lucky to visit on my way here in Philadelphia and to go through all her field notes. And she actually spent a year and a half in the same village that I'm working in, so this was really great. And, okay. So people in this area mainly derive their identity from a common origin place or from a center place. So the people that I work with call themselves Fadem. And Fadem Kar, the Fadem place, is the place where their ancestors come from. Now, the term Fadem and the group it refers to overlaps exactly with the term or with the speech variety Komzo. So one could equate Fadem people with Komzo speakers. So the term for their language is Komzo Tokwati, which means translated more or less just speech or only words. Okay, and of course, if language is so tightly connected to place, we know this from many other places in the world, then people would always reason in the sense of we speak this language because it's connected to the place that we live in. So lots of cultural practices relate to this. You have to address story places in your language and in no other language, for example. Okay. Oh, well, and I should say that, of course, this origin place forms an exogamous group, so you're not supposed to marry people who come from, or you're not supposed to marry a wife that comes from your origin place. Okay. So then, within this exogamous group, we have what's being called by Mary as non-local sections because they're replicated in different villages. And these have those three terms, Sangara, Mbango, and Mayawa. This is not supposed to be geographical, but just to show you. And again, those are exogamous. So as a Mayawan man, you're not supposed to marry another Mayawan. Of course, not from your own group, but also not from a different place. Okay. So we have these these different origin places to the west and to the north. So this is a bit geographical. And the one next to the west is Medkar, and people speak Wadat Tokwe, and to the north is Damgar, and the people speak Antar Tokwe. Okay, so these people live nowadays in villages. So there's three villages that belong to this: Oroku, Yokwa, and Uparua. And this is against their traditions. They used to live more in smaller hamlet type of settlements, sometimes just a family, and it was more or less outside influence, so missions and schools, government stations that didn't really force them in terms of brutally force somebody, but certainly encouraged them to move into larger settlements. So these days a village would be between 200 and 300, 400 people. Okay. So I talked about exogamy before. So this is a slide from Nick Evans about related language Nen with the terms. You're supposed to marry, well, the system is based on direct or symmetrical sister exchange. So your wife comes from a different village and from a different section, but also your wife is the sister of the man who's going to marry your sister. Okay, so you have another man in a different village and you're basically exchanging sisters or classificatory sisters. Okay. So since the residence is very local, this facilitates, of course, a high degree of multilingualism. Women almost always come from another place and hence speak a different variety. So the language, you could say the language of somebody's mother is not his or her mother tongue, okay? Because his or her mother tongue is the language of the place. Okay? And people do prefer so-called, what Mary Earth calls, short marriage cycles. So a daughter would typically marry back into the village of her mother. So there are sort of stable relations between certain pairs. Okay. So before I went, and this is enough about the cultural background now, so my expectation was before I went to the village, more or less, and it's just putting it very simply, men would speak the local variety, women speak the variety from another place. So on my first field trip, this was a very short one, as you can see. It was just to establish contact, to find a community of speakers that's interested and willing to work with me, to host me. It was 2010. So, okay, and I will be addressing those 2 points. So that's a map of the area again, and that's a map according to the way Ethnologue categorizes these languages. So the ones, especially ones in blue, are the so-called Tonda languages. And you can see Komso is not on there. That's because Komso is classified as a dialect. And as I arrived there, I was invited to the village of Uroku, where people speak Komso. And in the description of the people, the situation is of course different. So as we heard before, the labels language, dialect are difficult. And in the eyes of the people there, certainly those are different languages. Okay. So okay, you only have to remember basically those ones. Which I'll address. Okay, so during this first field trip, I was adopted into a Maiwa family, and they discouraged me from working with others. Well, especially with particular other people in the village. But this is a village of 200 people, everyone knows everybody, you run into people all the time, especially all the Mbangu sections and some of the Sangara families. And the reasoning was always to speak mixed. They speak mother's language, or they speak Anta, or they speak Wera, so the varieties to the variety to the west and to the north. Of course, at the beginning, I happily ignored that and worked just with everyone, and this led to a continuing stream of contradicting evidence. So even simple things like collecting vocabulary, you get corrected a couple of times every day, back and forth. Somebody tells you, no, this is really this language, and this is really that language, and you get re-corrected the next day. It's hugely frustrating. So, okay, what did I do in terms of strategies? Well, probably what everybody does, I focused on working with a very small number of people, especially given the short time of just 6 weeks during this first field trip. So I was basically only working with my father and my brother. And but of course I was conversing with everybody else, and as you do, you ask what's this and what's that. And so I always kept a tally to note the differences and the recollections of other people. but I didn't do a systematic data collection since it was only 6 weeks. Okay. Then I want to say, and then I observed language use, and I want to say a little bit about this. So basically, in school, they told me that there's a small school in the village, but everything after year three, children go to Moorhead, which is just a few kilometers further, but there the language of instruction is of course English, because you have lots of children coming from everywhere. Oh, and by the way, this is not a Tokpisin area. This is an area where English is the lingua franca. So they told me that in the school in the village, they had specifically chosen two individuals that speak Komso, because they speak proper language, and they want to have somebody who speaks pure Komso. But unfortunately, I always noticed that the school was largely dysfunctional. One of the teachers had gone to Moorhead and worked there, and was replaced by a speaker from a different variety from the north. The other teacher was a bit of a slack guy. He didn't really teach at all, I have to say. But okay. So this is one sort of observation that I made. Okay. And another observation is, of course, in public discussions, the topic of language was always brought up. It was always very important. And it was always brought up in the terms of the mothers are the ones who are not properly teaching our children the pure Komso language. Mm-hmm. So this is an example that I recorded last year along the lines of this. Komso language is the true language of the Fada people, but because the mothers got married to this place, they come from, these are different areas around it, from Adamba, Wera, Ulaya, Meta, and they brought their languages, and this is why the Komso language is fading away. They don't speak Komso properly, they mix the language. Oh, when you look at it today, then the foreign people are searching for the language. What's the real language? People mix with this language. Oh, sorry, some people mix some languages with this, and others mix other languages with this. So, and that's because the mothers don't teach it in a proper way. Okay. So this was the feeling that I left at this first short field trip that I left the field with. So sort of disappointed, a bit frustrated. I didn't really know what's going on. I thought maybe I'd chosen the wrong village. There are lots of people mixing here. Maybe I should have just gone, surveyed a bit longer and gone a few kilometers further. So, okay. So for the next field trip, which is much longer, I thought I need to understand the social structure there much better. So the micro social structure in the village. And of course I need to gather comparative data on the different varieties. So I collected genealogies, thanks to Peter's great tool. KinOath, which I can really recommend to everyone, and I gathered data on the different varieties there. So this is just to give you an overview, and I'm not making a big point about this here, but we have a 350 item word list for the whole project of the area, which covers a couple of other languages. So a comparative list here, and the ones color-coded blue are this Tonda family, and yellow is a different subgroup of the family. So Nama is fairly different, but these are all spoken sort of adjacent in the area. And according to this, you can see that Komso and Wera on lexical data probably be classified as dialects. And Komso and Anta are even a bit closer than Wera. But if we look further to the pronouns, for example, then Komso falls out of line. For example, it has in the possessives, it has, Wera and Anta have Nzone and Zane, so you have a change in the vowel, and here you have a change in the vowel plus a suffix. Okay, so I'm rushing through this. And in the morphology, you have something pretty weird happening, sort of a flip over between the allative case marker and the ergative case marker, between Komso on the one side and Wera and Anta on the other. So there are, what I'm trying to say is there are some differences between those varieties spoken in the village. And the more I got comparative data, the better I could, of course, tune in and sort of pick or understand whether that particular person is talking, what language he's talking right now, okay? Okay. I think I said that. Okay, and technically, yeah. All these three ones that I showed on the map earlier were all spoken in the village by different individuals who claim to be Fada people or who are Fada people. Okay, so the picture was much different than what I had expected when I said before, I expected man to speak the local variety. So in fact, it's quite a bit different. Okay, so in the third field trip last year, I said I'm out to get more fine-grained sociolinguistic data. And of course, then later to answer the question to myself, why are people talking different varieties, when really they should be talking the local one. And this was partly, this fine-grained sociolinguistic data especially was partly spurred by a survey team that had visited the village. I'm not going to go into details here, but they had done a very coarse-grained. They had done very much the opposite. Okay, so the questionnaire included basic information, of course, language proficiency, which language do you understand, which language do you speak to person X, and so on. It included questions on identity, what's your language, and language attitude. And this term, mixing languages, is a difficult term, but I asked people what's your opinion on this. Okay, what's more important is the interview style. So I did this in an interview style to sit down with a single person, sometimes with my sister, who would help me to translate and to understand. And I carried this out, so you can see it's 41 participants, but I carried it out within a period of about a month in the field. So I took a lot of time to do this. And I did this in order to minimize, I didn't want to have lots of people around when I asked somebody. So when I ask a woman, I ask her, what's the language of your spouse, or what's the language of you speak in a household, I didn't want her husband sitting next door. Okay. Now, I'll probably do a quantitative analysis at some point, but for this talk, I'll just tell you what came out in a qualitative way. Basically, almost everybody said that his self-ascribed language, so the answer to the question, what's your language, is his or her father's language. Or more or less, I should be more concrete, saying the language of the father's origin place. So somebody had told me, for example, an old woman had told me that her language, although she had come from the neighboring village, she said her language is not really the one from the neighboring village. Because although she grew up there, her father had moved to this village from even further down. So her language was really the one, okay? So this is what I mean in the third point. And the second point was that language mixing is portrayed uniformly as something negative. But at the same time, everyone is multilingual. So language mixing in the eyes of the people there really means speaking sort of the wrong language at a particular context. So when you're in the village here, you're supposed to speak Komso. And when you're in the other village, you're supposed to speak Werder. Okay? So, but of course, this question's left. Why did some people in the village speak this other language? So I went back and looked at I reread basically the anthropological material, and I found some interesting explanations. So if we go back to this slide before, I said, I used this to explain exogamy. Basically, what I said was Mayawa people shouldn't marry within their section. They also shouldn't marry within their origin place. And what I didn't notice, there's yet another group of people. They're referred to as Fetkambe. And Fetkambe are the people with whom you share a boundary. And they're the people you turn to if you don't, for example, if you don't have a sister, but you want to get married. So you have to borrow a sister. And you would do that either within your section or within your clan, or you do this within your Fetkambe. So this is sort of a group that is important also in other cultural practices, like attending dances. You would attend a dance with your Fetkambe group. They come along and dance with you. So to confuse you a bit more, if we now put in different origin places, right? This would mean that the Mayawa man cannot marry this Mbangu here, although this guy is, this woman is from a different origin place and from a different section, but he shares a boundary belonging to this category. Okay, so what had happened in Roku was that this process that I described before as village consolidation, where people moved from smaller hamlets into villages, didn't always follow these origin place or speech variety lines. But in some cases, it followed these Fetkambe lines. So some people from the Sangara section and some people from the Mbangu sections went to their site, to their Fetkambe, to their this group, and stayed there. And hence their children, when they came back, grew up speaking the other variety. Okay. So as conclusions. At the very beginning, calm down and keep documenting, keep notes, and we'll figure it out. And the other part is, of course, sociolinguistic question doesn't matter if they carried out the right way. I didn't get into the critique of this other type. But also, I should say that the mothers, it wasn't their fault. Thank you.
Seems to me there's an inherent ideological conflict in the system between what's de facto linguistic exogamy and a certain set of rather purist beliefs about how and what variety of children should grow up with. And it's being projected and being blamed on a sort of post-colonial setting, but it was inherent in the system before that, I would think. And well, I'd just like to know what you think about
that. So in some sense, this multilingualism was always there.
Yeah.
Not the case that children are, I mean, old men or men especially would tell you that small children are supposed to speak only the language of the village, but really that's probably not what happened. Especially if you consider that there were these stable links between, what I said, a short marriage cycle between two places or a couple of places. So then really everyone spoke the language of the other place as well. It's more in terms of status, which one. But I mean, if you talk to the people themselves who claim to be Fadim, they're in these individual interviews, that's why I really recommend them. In the public speaking, they would probably never admit that they even speak this other variety. But if you talk to them individually, that was much more revealing. And they would blame themselves and say, no, we're not supposed to speak this, and we're forgetting our language. And so they would really take it as a bad thing.
Is it actually the case that the children of these exolingual mothers are not learning the father's language properly? Because it happens, like say in Arnhem Land, a lot of places, that children just grow up speaking their mother's language better, but at a certain point on reaching late adolescence or whatever, they really should have mastered the father's language and have by then. And the methods you're outlining wouldn't necessarily detect that, right?
No, not at all.
See how these people are speaking.
I didn't record children. I didn't. In this sense, I didn't record people. So I didn't record the speech of people, but I recorded this sociolinguistic questionnaire and asked them individually. So yeah, I would detect that.
Under the circumstances, after a number of generations, you would expect certain domains belonging to women's business domains and things to be almost fully lexicalized and the same in both languages. And
but
whereas, for instance, hunting would be, that would be the problem area.
Yeah.
Is there such a division to be made between domains?
I will. But certainly there are also, you shouldn't forget that there are also younger women who are not married. So they grew up in the village speaking the language of the village. So not per se every woman speaks the, so every mother, I should say, speaks the, or every married woman speaks the language of an outside village. And of course, what I didn't mention, there's of course a lot of exceptions to the rule.
But does that really affect what I'm saying? I mean, if you have, well, to use something very traditional, and maybe people don't like it, but kitchen utensils and cooking would be for the women, and hunting would be for the man. You would expect that kitchen and utensils in the kitchen and cooking being should relaxify much faster than other domains, or the mixing would happen there full on, whereas it wouldn't happen in other areas, or it would be corrected in other areas.
Yeah.
Would that is that
and I cannot tell you, but that's a great suggestion to do.
looking at this as a language ecology rather than considering a more multilingualism aspect of it only, rather than focusing on one language, one village, and what influences there are in it from other languages, but also just looking in terms of all the languages and what that means for them interacting with each other on the whole.
Yeah.
I think
I don't really know how to respond to that, so yeah. I looked at this much here much more from the terms of how did I deal with it in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, put yourself in a situation that you have to write a grammar of one of these languages, but you don't know what you're describing. You don't know what's your community that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
You only notice that there's a certainly strong attitudes about different varieties, and there's a presence of different varieties. So how do you make sense of this?
I think that what I'm wondering is if, with coming from the perspective of writing a grammar of one language, if that itself is problematic.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a pan-dialectal grammar, something
mm-hmm.
like that. Because obviously this is like a, I think at the end this will be like a dialect chain.
Mm-hmm. Is there any question of, not necessarily within the community itself, but beyond the community levels of prestige, differences among the languages
not
or
much.
Dialects?
No.
No, so they're all considered
yeah,
equal?
They're all considered equal.
Other than where they are supposed to be?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
And the reasoning is usually that you need to know the terms of your place.
Yeah.
It's not that the other language is somehow inferior or something. I mean, everybody speaks it anyway. The other language, I mean.
What's the level of English fluency or presence?
I would say, well, it's of course tied to education. I would say maybe 5 or 10% of the people did go to, say, year 8 or year grade 10. So they have a very good command of English.
But outside of them, very little.
But outside of them, it's very, very small.
I'm just wondering, if you've got this really short marriage cycle, so if you've got the mothers are speaking their variety and they're teaching their daughters and the daughters presumably, especially if they're marrying really young and going back to the village where the local language is their mother's language, it's not clear how much the girls are actually going to learn the language of their father's village at all. And I wonder if anyone has talked about, it sounds like you set up almost to develop a women's language and a men's language in this situation. Does anyone talk like this?
In terms of women's and men's language, no. Not at all.
I don't know when the women are going to learn the father's village.
They would
language.
Have learned this before from, well, they would have learned before from their mothers who are coming from, well, but this is also not, but expected that at least one of the woman's daughter marries back to the village. Not the case,
right.
But still, I mean, it's not that they marry far away. There's still a limited number of varieties that would come into contact. At least the immediate surrounding ones, everybody has a fluent command of them.
So when they say the children are supposed to learn X language, they don't actually mean the boys are supposed to learn X language.
No.
Okay.
Okay, sorry, yeah, I didn't mean to come. Yeah, okay, I didn't mean to read that. Yeah.
In the interview excerpt that you showed, there seemed to be a bit of a discourse of this mixing is getting worse, because
yeah.
The mothers are here now and the kids, they're not learning it right anymore. That's a really common discourse in language context, right? Our kids, they're losing the pure variety. I was wondering in the interviews with the people of different generations, if this is getting somehow put in a time frame of like this is a current thing, or if it's an attitude
not much in the time frame, but everyone uniformly says that it's getting worse. But I don't know if that's the case. Because you have, what I didn't mention was that there's lots of exceptions to the rule that you marry outside your origin place. So actually some of the men who, because their fathers were in this other village, so they are now in their 40s or 50s and they speak Wera, another language. There's actually, and this is a really small group, right? So 2 or 3 families can affect a lot. Anyway, what I was going to say is that those 2 or 3 men, they have actually married against the law and married within their group, hence they have married a woman each, which is a Kondo speaker. So in the sense they are sort of, by breaking the law, they're repairing it again. Yet at the same time, when you talk to them, they say it's getting much worse. So I'm not really sure in terms of how to assess that. I think right now it's pretty stable.
Okay, so you may have more questions, but it's about time. And if you have a question, we have a reception at 5:30. So please.